Hello, and welcome to the third millennial 2016 Hangout, and this is with Henrik Palmgren of Red Ice. Hello, Henrik.
Hey, MW, Mr. Woes, how's it going?
M-dubs. That's what I was christened by TRS.
There you go, yeah.
Yeah, so I think we're going to talk about... Your view of 2016 and Red Ice and how it's done, how it's developed this year, because obviously you've started the TV channel this year. So, okay, what would you say about 2016 in comparison with 2015?
Oh, man.
Because you have to cover everything. I mean, so you...
the rocket's been fired off here, you know? We're in orbit right now. No, but I mean, obviously it's been a tremendous year for people of our ilk and people who are more or less on our page and agree with stuff. I mean, this is the year when things really have started moving and when all the hard work, the groundwork that people have been doing for, well, decades in some cases, have really paid off. And 2016 has been, I think, also the year when more and more newcomers have come on than ever because of, you know, everything that's happened out there in the real world.
The real life events, and also the left itself has just got so crazy.
Yeah, all the SJW stuff, and yeah. I mean, they've literally fallen over the rails, and it's all to our benefit, which is great. You know, their insanity just doesn't stop, and we're reaping the rewards from it, and the more absurd they get, and the more sensible our ideas are. And it's not because
our ideas have changed. It's because they've just become ever more hysterical.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I know that some, of course, among us, they take extremism to their, you know, to their advantage, and I definitely understand that tactic. That, you know, this broadens the room for the discussion. It makes so-called less extreme positions seem just that, less extreme. So it's beneficial. But frankly, many people have just remained in the position that they've always been in. I mean, I know people who are 50, 60 years old who have just, they have been like old school, you know, Swedish social democrats, lefties. And their opinions are now seen as like, some of their opinions are seen as like right wing and almost close to fascism because they haven't just, you know, bowed completely to the new definitions that the left has set.
Absolutely. The sort of epitome case of this was Germaine Greer. I can't remember what it was. I think she was going to speak at the Oxford Union Debating Society or something like that. And there was a bunch of Antifa protesting that because she's not trans friendly. She doesn't. I don't think she really believes in the whole trans thing. So therefore, it's like third wave feminists punishing second wave feminists for not being feminist enough by their standards. And there was another thing actually related to that, because trans is a big. That's sort of like the cutting edge of all this, and so you see these cases. And another one was the director. There was a film in the late 90s called. I think it was called Boys Don't Cry. And it was with Hilary Swank playing a guy who was pretending, you know, like a trans woman or whatever. And anyway, that was that. That was like 16, 17 years ago. And the director of that was rounded on by Antifa because she had cast a woman to play what would have been a biologically male role. And that was viewed as just unacceptable, like outrageous, transphobia. Now, I mean, that kind of thing, it's amazing now how correct you have to be. I mean, you can imagine that this woman would be, you know, a pretty diehard lefty liberal. She was trying to raise awareness of this this issue. And that was, as I say, that was 17 years ago. And now she's paying for it because she didn't do it well enough. I mean, it's amazing.
It quickly goes over the rails, as I said. It's all you have to do is just stand firm in your beliefs, and eventually you'll be considered radical. and extremism. And,
well,
and
I mean, look at Jordan Peterson at the University of Toronto. He's refusing to use trans pronouns. So he's getting attacked. Well, not attacked, but certainly verbally attacked by Antifa and SJWs and so on.
Yeah, some of these guys are, as I said, they're like an old school kind of lefty, you know. Strangely enough, even communism like was never this radical in its SJW things. I mean, it was fairly conservative on those issues, as far as I know. I mean, the Soviet Union wasn't that big on gays, you know.
No, so. As far as I know, it was socially quite conservative because they just weren't. Yeah. I mean, there wasn't much use for that. As far as I understand it, they just didn't have an interest in it because it wasn't useful to them politically, strategically.
Yeah, I mean, I know it wasn't a thing that they needed to use politically, because that's all this is. We got to remind people that, you know, all these different victim groups and everything else, I mean, they're just pawns in the game of control and subjugation of our society. I mean, at the end of this, they have destruction in mind, destruction of our societies, destruction of our people, of our nations.
And yeah,
they'll use whatever they can at their advantage to complete that goal. And in this case, they're using these so-called poor groups, right, just to, like, you know, talk down to us, you know, make sure that we lose, basically.
Yeah, it's dismantling, discrediting us. Not even us, not you and me, the mainstream, and anything that is established. You know, this is what the left does. It's what it's... And it used to do it on economic grounds, on class grounds, and now it's there are some who are still concerned with that, but it's largely social now, and it is all about that. I mean, the sort of Machiavellian nature of it is kind of sickening, because they pretend to care, but it really is. And of course, there are the useful idiots who do care, but. Underneath that is this, oh God, this almost psychopathic loathing of any order and any hierarchy, and any tradition. It's difficult to believe it, you know, because it's almost like a cartoon of, you know, the rebellious 15-year-old. And but, you know, there are people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s and 70s now who still have that mentality, and that's because it's so integral to their identity.
They're still kids, most of these people, you know. When if you actually get a chance to talk with any of one of them and kind of examine their worldview a little bit, you realize that these are kids. They never really grew up. They never really got in touch with reality, and they're living isolated from, you know, real life.
But it's this lack of self-reflection as well. I mean, I keep using this phrase, but it just keeps being relevant to things. You know, someone who has the politics of a 15-year-old when they're 35, there's something wrong there. You know, they've never really looked at themselves and wondered, why do I still have these feelings?
Yeah, whatever they do, they're always going to be right. So there's never going to be an issue of debating or talking or reasoning about these things. And in their conviction, in their, in their ignorance of reality itself, they're going to end up doing tremendous amounts of damage. And I think there's two groups of people, as you say here. There's one that intentionally wants that chaos downfall, destruction. That's all they know how to do. It's a culture of critique. They're just critiquing, breaking down, destruction. That's all they know, because they want that chaos. And the other group is, as you say, they're the useful idiots, and they basically just want to do things that make them feel good, morally speaking.
Yeah, and they think they're building a utopia.
Right.
So there's going to be a glorious revolution, and then after that, everything will be better.
We're all equal. But look at the violence that these people are creating at the end of the day, and that's where the lack of self-reflection comes in, that they don't really look and examine, like, okay, now we've had multiculturalism, open borders, mass migrations for, you know, well, some of those things for decades, some of them just after the migration wave for the last 2-3 summers here, open borders. We've had that for, you know, about 3 years or so, to the extent that, you know, that this radical, extreme radical mass migration. And look at the world that is, who of these people can look at the world and say, you know what, it's a much better place today than it was even just 3-4 years ago. Who can do that with a straight face?
Well, I do wonder about that. What do they think? Presumably the thought does occur to them sometimes that things aren't any better now than they were 4 years ago or 5 years ago. I wonder why that is. And maybe they just think, well, it's because of the racism. It's because of white racism. So we've still got to work on that. Yeah.
And once we've fault.
Oh, Trump.
Farage, you know, whoever, you know, Wilders, the Sweden Democrats.
Mm.
You know, it's always their fault. There's a, well, they don't have any power, right? They don't. I mean, Trump does soon, I hope. But you know, some of the other ones, yet they don't leverage too much power. In fact, look at Wilders. He's going to go to prison now, right? He was actually convicted for hate crime.
Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen with him. I know that after the sentence was passed, his popularity ratings went up.
Great.
But I didn't. I don't know I don't know what the sentence is going to be. If he's going to prison or if it'll be a big fine. I mean, the way he's been treated, and I don't even particularly trust him. But,
sure, I agree. Yeah. He's a reflection. You know, like Trump, he's a sign of things that are going in the right direction. At least that's what I see.
But yeah, yes. Go ahead. Yeah, yeah. But he himself is. Well, who knows? Who knows what he believes and what he would do and all the rest of it. Either way, the way he's been treated is just incredible. I mean, I believe it was in his case a few years ago that the famous quote came out, "The truth is no defense." I.e., it doesn't matter if what you're saying is true. And I hope I'm not misremembering that.
I think you're right. Yeah, I think one of them, that's happened a few times, that line, I think. But yeah.
What kind of world are we living in, you know?
Everything is out the window at that point. Like, okay, it's our way or the highway. I think it's true in Germany too, by the way, when it comes to questioning like World War II and those kinds of things. It's like it doesn't matter what actually is true. I mean, they're never going to like debate that in a court of law because it's already been established in a court of law legally what happened. So if you do question that, you have the right to go to jail. Because you're questioning a historical fact that has been put into legislation.
So that's
the kind of world we're looking at here. I mean, look at how things also has transformed from our opposition's point of view in 2016, that the pressure back towards us because of our increasing popularity, because of our appeal, because of more people listening and understanding our concerns and understand that the things we're talking about are legitimate issues, and this, you know, cartoon version of what it is that we're talking about that they're projecting upon us doesn't actually fly anymore. It doesn't work. And those people have realized that, you know,
I think that one example of that is really not flying anymore is the idea of white racism and even white privilege. I mean, white privilege, here's the thing, you know, as I've said before, white privilege is a real thing. And there's no real point in, I mean, yeah, there are some examples, some instances in society where it simply is not the case because white people are so fair, they're so diligent. But by and large, it is good to be white in a white society. And it's kind of delusional when when people deny that. The point is, it's right to have, I mean, in every other society, the main ethnic group, the ancestral group, has privilege. And that's exactly as it should be. That's an inevitable and natural and right thing. That's a wee rant I've gone on. The point I was going to make was that the idea of white privilege as something pervasive and toxic, I think, is rapidly losing currency. And I also, definitely, the idea that white people are guilty in general, I think, is rapidly losing currency. I mean, I think to some extent that realization will explain Trump's victory. I mean, right. I think Americans are just sick of being told to feel sorry and guilty all the time.
Sure, exactly. And I think the way you disarm and deflate that lie, that weapon they use against us of, you know, white privilege or whatever is as you say, okay, is there yellow privilege in Asia, you know, or in China? And as you say, yes, there is, because that's that's what society is. It's a big function that is meant to benefit your descendants. You know, that's exactly what the whole thing is about.
It would be bizarre.
You have privilege because it's a survival strategy of every group that has ever lived and worked together on this planet, is to hand over privilege, if you will, to their offspring.
I mean, what would be the point of society if it did not privilege your descendants? What's the point of your society if it doesn't do that for your descendants? It's just day-to-day maintenance in that case. It's just, let's all be prosperous now, but who gives a shit about our kids and grandchildren and our great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren? People don't really work like that. You know, if you're going to contribute to society and build it and all that, you're going to need to believe. And just in general, I think to get through life, you need to believe in something bigger and bigger than yourself, and it's going to outlast you. And your people is a good candidate for that. You know, your feed, your ethnic group, your cultural group.
It's the most important thing that there is. And I know people in our world, most people, most normies, unfortunately, they don't see it that way. At least in the Western world, at least white people.
Well, but absolutely, they've been so deracinated. I've spoken to several people in the last week in the skeptic community who just casually say, I don't care what happens after I die. I mean, this attitude is incredible. And you hear it from perfectly intelligent people. Sorry?
They're dead inside. They're not living. These people, I mean, literally, they grow up in a system where they become so self-loathing and so self-hating that they literally have no life in them anymore. You know, from the kind of the utilitarian mindset to this, I mean, I almost seem as a kind of, they want like a social experiment of everything, that, you know, you're not entitled to work hard in your life and then hand that off to your own sons or daughters, because they want everyone on a blank slate, as you say.
Intentionally
weaken people. You intentionally have to, like, if someone is talented, you intentionally have to break their legs so that you're equal with the one who suck. Right. Yeah. And that's why our society suck, because we're trying to take down everyone who is rising above the rest. You know, it's that crab mentality of whoever is trying to escape the bucket of our misery. Well, let's not, like, encourage them to get out. Let's you know, pull them down together and keep them all in there. You know, it's so destructive. You know, it's sick.
Yeah, it is sick. But to get back to the point, I think that 2015 was a pretty alarming year, obviously culminating with the migrant crisis, Merkel's decision last September, which was just startling and incredible and surreal. But then 2016, we've seen we've seen a lot of results of that. I mean, I can't even remember them all. Cologne was the first thing, then the Brussels bomb. I think there was another one.
Was it Paris, or was that the year before?
That was November. That was November last year.
That's right. Yeah.
Which is when I appeared on your.
That's right. Website. Yeah. There you go.
It was just after that. That was what we spoke about. So then there was Cologne, Brussels. I think there's something else that I'm forgetting. And then
in Germany, I know.
Yeah, and then in June or July there were the four attacks in Germany, and then this Berlin attack, and of course Nice, that's the one I'm forgetting. Nice,
that's right. Yep.
That was
brutal. Remember the child lying under that aluminum silver blanket, and it's like, why did that, someone did put that next to each other, the image of what's his name again? Corsi, the kid who drowned on the beach, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that became iconic, right, of like the whole insanity in the movie and the justification for our ethnic replacement, basically. And but that child that in Nice didn't get that treatment, you know.
No, that photo has just been forgotten about. I mean, we in the alt-right remember it, but I think most normal people, normies, I think if you showed them it, they might dimly remember it, but whereas the one of, I can't remember the boy's name, it's a very, very famous photo. He's got the red t-shirt on and all that, and
blue,
it's just
pants. Yep.
Yeah, and the blue pants, and it's and even the posture is, you know, it's etched into our memories because it was broadcast so widely and pervasively, and you can't get away from it. So that is, I'm sorry, I'm just trying to remember the boy's name.
And because
Alan Curdy.
Yeah, that's right.
Something like that. Alan Curdy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, the obviousness of that tactic is almost embarrassing. You know, you just keep showing them this photo of one dead toddler. And let's be honest, I mean, nobody wants a toddler to drown to death, to drown. It's awful. But the idea that that should then be used to replace or to, let's say, displace ethnic Europeans in their homelands is simply ludicrous.
Did you see all the statues that they did to this child in different parts of the world? And it was like in India and in Iraq, I believe, or something. There was people even did demonstrations when they laid performance art. They lay down on the beach with like red t-shirts and blue pants, and like, you know, hundreds of people being photographed.
Yeah, I did see one of those. I think it was in London. There was some sort of flash mob thing where they they did that, and it's. You know, it's embarrassing because so much of what the left does, and that's a good example of it, is simply, as you said, about breaking down society. Let's all pretend to be Alan Kurdi, and then that means that everyone on Earth is Alan Kurdi, and therefore we should all just forget about national borders and that identity that means so much to you. It's just an illusion because we're all Alan Kurdi now. I mean, this is
somehow woes also to then. You know, that mentality is supposed to change our hearts, right? So that we would say, oh my God, let's open the borders, which is going to do what? It's going to cause even more people to jump on those boats sinking. And actually, the mentality is actually leading to people's deaths, not ours. Ours is like, no, actually, let them stay where they are.
If you want to help them,
they can be helped there.
Yeah, exactly. If you want to help them, we can do it there. And we can help them in their own homelands. Requisition a large area of land in North Africa. They can go there and we'll govern it, keep them safe, and, you know, whatever. I don't care. But the worst option is to bring them here. Not only because it means that a lot of them will die in the process, in the journey, but also it just completely retards our societies. I mean, Germany this year has been tragic to watch. I mean, this is something I sort of intuitively feel that, and I don't have any evidence for it. It's something I suspect that as soon as you have a large number, a considerable number of foreigners in your society, in your ethnic group's territory, that retards your sense of ownership of that society because you know that, well, your grandfather could have tended to that garden, built that wall, knowing that his people would benefit from it 100 years in the future. But you can't do that anymore. You've got no idea who's going to benefit from whatever you build. And it might be someone who looks nothing like you, speaks nothing like you, and so on.
Who hates you, in fact.
Oh, it could be someone who hates you. Or even worse, it could be someone who's just totally ambivalent to you and everything you represent. Which I think a lot of foreigners are. I mean, a lot of non-whites. I think they don't hate us. They're just totally ambivalent. They don't care.
Yeah, they don't.
It means nothing to them.
Otherwise, they wouldn't have left their own countries, right? To a certain extent.
Yes,
they would have stayed there. They would have fought there. Is this temporary, fleeting, selfish reasons in many regards? Because many of us have talked about. Very few actually of these people actually flee from real war. This is just they are opportunists. They're just jumping on this because they gave the go ahead and they're going to get free stuff, right? They come to our countries and they're going to get free shit, basically.
Yeah. The whole world's a hotel now, or a free for all, in fact. But the other aspect of it is, and I think you see this in Germany, once you have this large presence of non-Germans in Germany, for example, well, what does the average German do? How does he react? How should he emotionally react to that? How should he feel about his society then? How should he feel about his people then? It's very difficult for him to conceptualize those things at all anymore. Because if anyone can be German, then that means nothing. And if anyone can be German, then what is Germany? It's just a hotel. So the whole story has been disrupted. And I mean, the historical story of that, because I mean, obviously you can say, well, Germany wasn't united in the first, it wasn't one big homogenous thing. Big deal. It was still a consistent story. I mean, all of those threads that make it up, they all go back into the past together. They don't.
They see the migration wave as a kind of a just a continuation in that natural progression of like a nation or a country or something, which it isn't. It's completely artificial and it's contrived. It's top down. It's decisions that have been made by globalists who think that our world is going to be a better place if there's no borders and no people or no homogenous region anywhere in the world, you know?
Yeah. Which is monstrous. It's simply monstrous. I mean, if you care about, and I don't necessarily care about diversity, but if you do care about diversity, then you should want to keep these things separate and distinct.
Oh, I'm all for it. I think actually we are the ones who are actually for diversity. That's actually the point. It's, I do actually appreciate diversity, and I'm, you know, if people want to see these cultures so bad, why not them be in a position where you actually can go and travel to them and experience them firsthand instead of
That's the thing.
Eradication.
That's the thing. At least the way it is just now, you can go and see these other cultures and other peoples in their ancestral territory, their lands. You know, you can go and see the Japanese, you can go and see the Nepalese, you can go and see the Indians, whatever. But it's uniquely us. We, our lands no longer belong to us. You can't really. Yeah. And if you say, I'll go to, I want to see the Europeans, I want to see the French, I'll go to Paris. Well, you'll go to Paris and you won't see many French people. And you will see French culture, but it's augmented, very heavily augmented with God knows what else. And so there is nowhere this idyll of, Parisian culture. It's at this stage it's very elusive. So we don't have that now. For now, that's the situation. It could be that the sort of grand plan is that eventually everywhere will be like this, and there won't be a single place in the world that's
right, because that would entail that we still Europeans are in the picture. And it's not. I mean, what other countries are they ruining like this? I'm not seeing that anywhere.
Well, I think they're making inroads in Japan, for example. I also think that other East Asian countries, like less prosperous ones, seem to be feeling the toxic effects of modernity as well. I mean, people don't have nearly as many kids as they used to. They don't want to do the shitty but necessary jobs anymore that their parents did, and so on. And of course, they're starting to get into homosexuality and so on. So, and I think it is affecting other parts of the world. I've also heard that a lot of Muslim countries have lower, like their birth rates are decreasing. I can't remember, was it the Gulf states? I can't remember now. I don't think
I think the most prosperous ones, I think, usually, if I remember correctly, it seems to be a pattern of like material success breeds kind of, I mean, there is a reasoning to that, of course, which is like, you know, planning of children, etc. That if you're in a country where, you know, a lot of your kids are going to die, your chances are you're going to have more kids to try to get a bigger outcome of a few of them surviving. So, you know, they'll shoot for like, you know, if they want to have, you know, three kids, they're going to have like eight or nine kids, and hopefully three or four. Well, those will survive, right? In our countries, we can plan, and then the likelihood is that, you know, we'll plan for two and we'll have two. So, you know, it's a kind of a success in terms of like you know, win over nature to a certain extent, if you will. But there seems to be a disease that comes with material comfort and success. Well, we end up outside of the realm of nature, and we give up on those drives and impulses that makes us like want to continue life, basically.
Yeah, indeed. And I've seen, I mean, I think that's very visible in young people today, people in their teens, 20s and 30s. I think in my own age group, and I've said this many times on the channel, that so few of them have kids. It's absolutely, it's terrifying. And I don't understand how they can't see. I mean, I don't have kids yet, but it's something I'm planning for and building for. I want to do it soon. The people I know don't even have it in their heads that that they should ever want to.
I've started changing my opinions on this, where I basically say, good. Like many of those people anyway, you'd actually want to see them taken out of the gene pool. And frankly, I think we are overpopulated. You know, when you travel and when you go around the world and stuff, it's like resources are being depleted. It's running out. People who like hunt for food has to push deeper and deeper and deeper into the wilderness to even find a lone, you know, buck standing there or something. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm scared of what our materialistic success have done to the planet. And I mean, there's countries out there now where they eat every animal. They eat the rats. They clean the bottom of the ocean. Chinese trawlers are going around in these, like, you know, Southern Pacific waters, and just like they're cleaning out everything to feed these, you know, as some of these globalists said, like Henry Kissinger, he called them useless eaters. And part of me at this stage is like, I agree. You know what I mean? Because it's like, what's the purpose of what are they doing? What are some of these people adding? Do you see what I'm saying? It's like, I'm into eugenics. So it's like, I want a betterment of humanity. I want more, you know, I'm for quality, not quantity. And I think we have to think long-term. We have to use that to our advantage. So yes, it might be a setback for us in terms of the numbers, but at some point there's going to be a colony collapse because of just an overwhelming amount of people. Just look at Africa, right? Projections are now at 4 billion by the end of the century. And how many of those billions are going to pour into Europe for a better life, economically speaking, because their own nations are failures in every possible conceivable way? I mean, it's just unsustainable. We're farming every piece of the land. Topsoil is depleted. We can't even feed ourselves anymore. And the sparse food that we do get, which is like amounts of like wheat and Cheerios today, is like, it's just nutritionless. So I'm, you know, I get your concern, but part of me is like, I'd rather have fewer of us, right, who are like sharp and on the ball, know what's going on, know what's happening, and have that become a tight-knit core that can actually prepare for what seems, at least at this point, to be a pretty gloomy future, to be honest, where way too many people are aboard, you know?
Well, I mean, that is very depressing, but I guess it is a necessary part of the cycle. I mean, the hard times will produce strong, resourceful, resilient people. And the age that we're in now is just full of weak, deluded, rudderless people. I mean, again, there are some things I could say about the last week, my interactions. There are just so many, weak people, I think, is the word. And I do agree with you. We can do without them. I mean, that is the silver lining to this whole thing.
We have to think long term. You know, we have to think long term. Short term, this is a disaster.
Short term, it's dispiriting and depressing.
Yeah. But you know, again, if we think long term, it's only those who are really driven, and those who can wake up to all of this and somehow see through all this. Even those who just don't care about ethnicity and decide to just mishmash out and blend out or whatever. I mean, they're visually taking themselves out of the picture. Yeah, that's going to be like, and those who are going to remain are those who actually care, and it's their offspring that's going to remain as well. And that's a good thing, you know. And it will be an even tight-knit group, smaller, yes, but much more proficient, smarter, more educated, more fit, basically. And I think this is nature's way of striking back. Whether we, you know, however we philosophize around that or try to justify that, that we think humanity is like, we won over nature. You know, look, we cured all these diseases and we did all these things that we could just reproduce and multiply like never before. But nature always wins at the end, you know, and if you can't find a way, maybe materially or physically, it seems that it's almost our own success have created a kind of a disease, a sickness in many people's minds today, unfortunately.
Which acts as a sort of limiting factor.
Yeah.
Like you get this successful and then you start self-destructing.
Right.
Mm. Yeah.
It goes around on itself and it finds a way of like continuing the process of us thinking that we're somehow going to, you know, win over nature or become so successful at a point that it no longer influences us or have any reach. That's delusional. And even if we go further than that, even if we go, you know, into these, I mean, you talked about the trans issue in the beginning.
Yeah.
And I see at the end of that, I see a complete transformation of the entire, in their view, what they want this to become at the end of it. I mean, I do see a completely, a reality and an existence, which is completely disconnected from that world, from that natural order of things. We're talking about things such as, you know, transhumanism and stuff like this, the final step in that trans cycle that they're onto, that is, you know, so, you know, now we're no gender or now we're no race. Soon enough, you're not going to even be a human being, right? You're going to have your brain uploaded to a computer or your soul or whatever. You're going to transcend life itself. But I mean, again, think of the nightmare that these people are moving themselves into and the future, which is just completely devoid of everything. I mean, they're talking about that virtual reality stuff catching on now, VR, you know, goggles or whatever. I mean, it's kind of a cliche, but it literally, I mean, it takes that red pill concept into a new phase as well, but it literally is like the Matrix, you know. It's like them, they're going to be so sick and tired of reality itself that they're going to do everything. They're going to beg to be liberated from it in a digital world where they would be able to control everything by a, you know, their what do you call it? Their desire to manifest things instantly. They're instantaneous. They're like a toddler, you know, who I demand it. I want it now. Just push a button and you'll receive it. You know, you'll live in a paradise forever. A perfect world, you know. They'll move themselves into that reality, which in their view is controllable and therefore so much better. But I think it's going to end with a nightmare, their paradise, you know.
I think that detachment from reality and from necessity is not something that people actually enjoy when it happens. It's something that people enjoy in very short bursts. But when you're actually living like that, for example, the modern neat, and I was one for a long time, has absolutely no direction, which is terrifying when you think about it. If you dwell on it, it's absolutely terrifying. When you don't know where your life's going, what you're for. That sounds philosophical, but it's
yeah. What's the purpose?
But it's not highfalutin. You know, it's something that hits you absolutely in the gut. When you're in that situation and when you let those thoughts come to you, it's not something, you know, you can have all these sensory pleasures at your fingertips. It means absolutely nothing if your life doesn't have meaning and purpose. And I do think that, the neat is a sort of prototype of what you're talking about. The sensory pleasures would get more intense and sophisticated, but the meaninglessness would also just spiral.
Yeah, be even more extreme in that moment, but that's also something we have to offer. We have, my background, growing up in Sweden and just living that kind of by default lefty socialist kind of living in that environment. That completely, and I think that's true for most European countries and now also America. That completely just meaninglessness, nihilism, just nothingness, and kind of course, people take a kind of a self-destructive pleasure in that to a certain extent. But, you know, when you wake up to many of these things and what happens, your sense of purpose is reinvigorated. And that's also partially of the success that we have. We've offered something which is real. It's a quest. It's a fight for life and death. It's a realization that we are in a war. Fight Club, they said, you know, we're the generation who's like, you know, in between or something. I think they said, they talked about we're not part of a great war, World War I or World War II or anything like that. And that's wrong. We're actually taking part in the biggest war right now that has ever faced, I think, this planet. It's an existential threat, right? And
a spiritual threat, I would say.
That too, well. Exactly. Well, everything is at stake. It's a make or break moment in history. And they, you know, our globalist enemies are, they're literally going for the jugular right now. They want to finish this thing off and put themselves in a position of complete control. And
oh yeah, I think that's why the migrant crisis
standing in the way.
Yeah, I think that's why the migrant crisis was engineered. I think they could see anti-immigration feelings growing, and so they thought, okay, let's just get as much done as we possibly can, as fast as we can. I think they could see that there was a reaction slowly brewing, and I think that's why it was done.
Which of course drove us even closer to being hating that more, which is funny because they're creating their enemies, right? If they ever feared us and they push the throttle, well, guess what? You're going to just hit that wall eventually. You're going to create more of us, and you're going to create us even stronger.
Yeah, this is what I said. I was speaking to Greg Johnson last night, and I said a similar thing to what I'm about to say, which is they're creating more and more of us. They can attack individuals in the alt-right. It doesn't matter. The alt-right is going to grow, and it might not even be called the alt-right in 2 years or 10 years. It doesn't matter. The reaction that it represents and currently embodies is unstoppable, and because these forces are not going away. These antagonistic forces are not going to dissipate. Modernity has to be handled somehow. It has to be addressed somehow, especially when it's intensifying all the time. So I think that this, as you say, we are growing and the numbers are growing. And it's because, as you just said, the alt-right, which is what we currently call this thing, and I qualify this because you shouldn't... I think Adam Wallace was correct about 8 months ago when he said that the alt-right is a category that we use just now, but it might morph and mutate and melt and reform and so on. It doesn't really matter. But whatever you want to call it, the impulse that it represents is a purgative, an immune reaction to this spiritual malaise that we're in. And we are in that malaise. And the reason that people are attracted to the alt-right and is that they sense that it represents some kind of solution. They sense that it represents a realization that, frankly, modern life is kind of shit. It's comfortable, but it's terrifyingly empty. And I think increasing numbers of people are feeling that. You're right. I agree with you that a lot of people shouldn't reproduce, but a lot of people should. And they, you know, if you get some 25-year-old guy who's got, you know, he's got balls, he's got direction, he's got ideas, he's got intelligence, and yet he doesn't know how to approach women, or he doesn't have a job, or whatever, then he is a victim of modernity. He might be a victim of other things as well, his upbringing, his own nature, whatever. But the fact is, a traditional society would have rescued him from those things. This society doesn't. And I think he recognizes that, which is why when he discovers pull, or whatever, he's amenable to it. You know, it's not a blueprint for how to get a wife tomorrow, but it is something. It's something meaningful. It's something productive. It's something healing, and we're getting there. And you know, that sort of system, that blueprint, will form like a jigsaw being formed over the years. And I think
that prototype or whatever that you're talking about, the archetype of that person, is like, he also has something in him that makes him get to a point where he questions, right? Where he reaches maybe even rock bottom to a certain extent, where he reaches that point of where he just doesn't give a shit anymore, you know?
Yeah.
And it's a liberation in that, of all these things you're supposed to think and feel in this society, and to reach that point where you just don't give a damn about any of that, you know. And it's a freeing kind of concept.
Oh yeah, you know? Absolutely. I think when people,
You know,
I think that when people finally shake off the drivel that they got at college or university, when they shake off the progressivism, it is a liberating thing because they don't have to find ways to, what's the word? Delude themselves, basically. They don't have to find some way to make these things make sense together anymore. And they don't have to defend the idea of equality anymore, which never made sense to them anyway. And they were never even sure what it was in the first place. But they were told at 18 that they had to believe in it.
Yeah, you do to be nice, right?
Yeah.
you want to be liked. Well, I mean, we're social animals, and this all makes sense, right? We want to be liked, right? We want to have that girl. You know, what do I need to do here? What's the signals? What people patterns do I adopt to?
Sorry, you're breaking up.
Society has been you is wrong. Oh, sorry about that.
Yeah,
everything society has been telling us is wrong. You know.
Oh, it is. I mean, if you tell men that women want them to be emotional and sensitive, well, you know, women do want you to be emotional and sensitive, but not all that much. I mean, their primary thing is they want you to be reliable and strong and stable. And if you're not that, then you're fucked. You don't stand a chance. At the same time, women have been told that men want them to be career women and strong and independent, and no, a man wants her to be loyal, sympathetic, warm, supportive, and not a bitch. And you look at these SJWs and these young girls, and they've got absolutely no idea what man do they think would want them the way they are. Yeah, right. I mean, this is part of the retardation. I mean, I could go into this in depth. What feminism has done to the relations between the sexes is amazingly sophisticated. It's like a virus planting all these problems throughout the system, such that it really struggles to function anymore. But that was something I wanted to say earlier. You know, the 24, 25 year old neat, the 27-year-old woman who's feeling the urge to have kids and so on. These are the victims of, frankly, the left. They've been indoctrinated at college or by their media, by the culture, into destructive lifestyles and destructive modes of thinking. And that is a sign of the hubris of the left. They think that they can just redesign these things. They think that they have humanity's, the soul of man, sussed out, and so they can just tinker with it and update it. And I think they really have no idea because they don't even know themselves. And so it's very difficult for them to really understand humanity in general. So I think that's why it works. Their work is successful on the 18-year-old who wants to believe. But it's not
the one who doesn't know anything about the world, right?
Yeah, and know about themselves.
The ideologues, you know, they have all these ideas and, you know, the utopian vision or whatever, but none of that, you know, anyone who's lived beyond that, you know, in terms of years, knows that's not how it works. That's why they always target this rebellious revolutionary class to the youngest people, you know, because they're the most naive and most stupid.
Yeah, exactly. They'll believe anything. And, as long as they think that it would piss off their parents, then they'll believe it. And so it works for, I don't know, how long would you say? I think that the SJWism starts to wear off by mid-20s in most people. That's the impression I get. It seems to be something, I mean, there are certainly outliers. You know, there are 30-year-olds, 35-year-olds who still believe in it. Yeah. But most of the time, it seems that they're in their early 20s or late teens. They're drunk on it. But it doesn't last very long, really. It certainly doesn't last very long after they've left university and they're either in some job or they're unemployed. And I mean, that in itself is disgusting. It's a crime that our society sets them up for that. And what were you going
to
say?
No, I was just that I think also what happens, unfortunately, is that they just become lukewarm after a certain point too, where they kind of hold many people still hold a lot of the kind of the similar opinions or like a, well, you know, human rights or, you know, we're all equal or, but they're not just as driven and passionate about it anymore. They've just kind of lost the drive to like try to influence or change something. They've kind of given up on it, but they still still go along with those kinds of basic assumptions, those wrong assumptions. You know?
Yeah, they believe in it because they don't know what else to believe in. I mean, they don't have an alternative.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, they haven't been shown the other side. They haven't been showed, you know, reality, things that make sense to them. I think most people, if you sit down and talk with them, most people would, if they gave, you know, you a chance to explain the other side to this story and what it is that's going on, I think most people would understand to a certain extent. If you could, you know, answer some of those basic, like, major questions that they would have along the way and kind of get those out of the picture.
I agree with you, because, you know, tradition, and I'm not even 100% advocating any and all tradition. I'm saying, however, that traditional morality was formed over a very, very long time, and it existed for a reason, and that reason basically is that it worked for a vast majority of people. So if you expose the modern nihilistic millennial to that kind of thing, those kinds of ideas, it will make sense to them because it simply does make sense and it marries up with human nature as it really is and has been for millennia.
And that's our way in. See, that's what we have to appeal to. That we have to find that sweet spot. I mean, it's not going to be the same for everyone, of course. There's different things. They run into different things in their lives and different things cause them to question or wake up or whatever, or just do a Google search, you know, crime, immigration, or, you know, keywords like that, you know, that like make them just, you know, open up, or globalism, or what do the globalists want, or, you know, whatever. But we need to find that appeal. We need to find that point where like they are exposed to something in a very short amount of time, but it says enough about the feelings that they have about things that you lure them in, right? That they're hooked at that point. And I think, you know, maybe memes, maybe that's the way in. You know,
well, memes do seem to work. It's a very successful thing. I think it has to marry up with the reality that they know, even if it's a reality that they've been trying to ignore. It should seem real to them and true to them. And then I think they are, that's the way in. Because the other obstacle is social acceptance, because our ideas are not socially acceptable. And this is something
which
where
also,
I think...
Which also value, right? I mean, that also, there's a rebellious spirit within many people, which then should be like, okay, well, if this is the way the world goes, and I kind of hate the world, what is against the world, right? That's it. There's an appeal to that. Maybe not to everyone, but to many it should be, and we can work with that.
Yeah, I agree. I also think that as the online community grows, I mean, there are going to be more and more people in every city, and even every town, with whom you can safely socialize and voice these ideas and just these attitudes. I mean, it's not even a matter of ideas. It's not like people want to get together and constantly talk about politics and tradition and morality. It's just a feeling of safety and brotherhood. And I think that will become more and more possible as our numbers grow, which they surely will. So I think the sort of social penalty of having these ideas is going to diminish.
Yeah, tribe and belonging. We all, these are things that are, you know, our modern society, excuse me, there are modern societies turned it back on, at least for white people, you know, for Europeans. We don't have that group usually, or that tight-knit, you know, gang or whatever you want to call it. And there's an appeal to that of having that sense of belonging. I think we have been so detailed that we have had all these subgroupings. You know, you're like into, you know, Lord of the Rings or, you know, a small little thing, which has been like, you know, our version of identity politics.
Yes, indeed. I think that this is something, I mean, these subcultures are so potent for people for some actually quite sinister reason, I think. Because, I mean, what I mean is they don't actually have something more solid.
Right, but the reflection of a need, you know, and a desire, yes, which is good, which is something I think we can work with.
Our
advantage.
I just mean
people will come aboard because of those things.
Absolutely. What I meant just now was that the things they've got just now, the subcultures they have just now, are not very nourishing. I mean, you know, to be right. into science fiction in a huge way, is not, you know, it's not enough. There needs to be something more transcendental than that, I think.
Yeah, but as of course, exactly.
yeah, but we are getting there. We are, I think, we are absolutely getting there. So, I guess, is there anything else you'd like to say about 2016 before we finish?
Yeah, I mean, what else had happened this year? I mean, it's meetings and conferences and more people. Trump, Brexit, of course. Even Italy saying no to the constitutional reform. All signs that something is brewing, which is not to the advantage of our globalist friends, you know.
Yeah, the only counter signal to it was the Austrian election, and you know, I don't know what to believe about that, because I'm sure one was rigged.
Yeah, some people speculated, and I wouldn't be surprised, to be honest. I guess in Austria, for understandable reasons from their perspective, that's the one country they wouldn't want to have turn in that direction, you know, because of their legacy.
Mm.
But I mean, overall, these are very good, very good signs. They're by no means, none of them stand alone or even all put together are by no means a complete picture of what needs to happen. But it's a trend development. It's moving in the right direction. And also think of it this way, as we kind of detail a little bit already, the more than that we gain traction, the more pushback it will be. And the more pushback you have, the more absurd pushback you have, absurd claims, absurd ideas are going to sneak itself into this picture, official policy by government, you know, making like a group like National Action, like a dedicated terrorist organizations where you can have radical clerics in imams or whatever, like run around in London and like literally advocating for terrorism and murder of people in Europe, where they basically don't do anything against, but a nationalist group that meets and have rallies and doesn't advocate violence, that's deemed a terrorist group. So I think we're going to see more of those kinds of attempts to shut down. It's going to be like it was a game whack-a-mole or something, you know, that as they hit one group, it's going to pop up in a different way. And that's the advantage of the alt-right. It's that decentralized cell structure that you can't, you know, it's like it just slips out of your hands and you try to pin it over here and over there and it pops up in a new direction, new area. I think coming out of left field, so to speak, you know, unpredictable, things that to a certain extent doesn't make sense. I mean, we like our rationality to a certain extent, but it's our irrational implementation of those rational ideas that is so powerful and so dangerous to the system. And that's something we have to be even better at. Of doing things that doesn't make sense to a certain extent. This sounds weird, but like things that catches people's attention. There's so much noise out there. There's so much, you know, buzz and there's so many things to look at and watch and listen to and everything. And we need to pierce through that noise to a certain extent. And so I want to see more of that. Yeah. And I think we can as we go into the new year.
I completely agree. I think that the alt-right is taking shape in a very big way. I mean, I knew that 2016 was going to be a major year. I knew that it was going to be good for us. But honestly, it was even better than I expected. I mean, Hillary's speech where she mentioned us was just hilarious. And then this whole Trump thing has been wonderful. I didn't know about Brexit, but it happened as well. And then this whole fake news thing more recently, I think that also plays into our hands. I think that
is excellent. You can have better promotion, you know, in a way.
No. So I think basically the powers that be, I think, are getting desperate because they don't know how to handle this situation. They're in over their heads, just as the Marxy-Warxy social science lecturers at colleges, they're in over their heads. They don't know really. They've reached a point where they cannot map it out any further. I think they're losing control, just as the real powers that be are losing control.
They're becoming like they're making stupid decisions. They're in retreat to a certain extent. We obviously, these are, you know, when you talk about society and the life of a nation, it extends itself far longer than in the cycle of a life of a single human being, obviously. So these are longer cycles of trends and things like that. But I think we're already seeing the tremendous short-term impact and power that this resistance have. But as I said, this has been obviously decades in the making, and now it's kind of it's come to a crystallization point to a certain extent. But yeah, in that desperation, they're going to make mistakes, which I think, like the Hillary speech and stuff. I mean, really, this candidate was meant to like deter people away, deter them into thinking, oh my God, this group or whatever. As you say, it couldn't have been better advertisements. It's the best thing that could ever happen. Talk about, I mean, there's articles coming out every day, all over the place. There's like, you know, TV production companies is reaching out to people like us and asking to like, they want to do shows on this, and they're trying to understand it. And while some journalists might be somewhat more genuine than others, it's a sign that this thing is growing, and it's not going to disappear. It's not going to go away. As you say, it might change name or something, or, you know, turn into something else. I see it as a cell division there too. It's like it's been in an embryonic state, and now it's dividing into more and more cells. It's growing into an organism, but there might also be splits in those parts, you know, different organs, different parts that do different things, but together it all works as one body, if you know what I mean.
I hope so. And I think that will happen. I think it's a sort of inevitability about it. So anyway,
that's inevitable.
Yeah, I think so. That's been a really interesting discussion. So let's end it there before we start grinding metal, because I am starting to get tired. I don't want
to. Tired. It was a bit jet lagged, you know, visiting some family, so I was kind of tired, but it was good. It was good. Thanks for...
Yeah, it's strange. Sometimes being tired can actually be an asset, because your brain works in a different way. So
That's true, I guess. Yeah.
Well, anyway, this has been with Henrik Palmgren from Red Ice. And so thank you very much, Henrik, for doing this.
Thank you, boys. Appreciate it.
Okay, and thanks everyone for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. See you later.